Savaka Sango Samichi Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sango Yati Dang Chatari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sango Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttara Punyaketa Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami.
Holding to false views, the pure
desires is not born again into this world. Sorrow, sorrow, sorrow.
Questions increasing or decreasing?
Increasing.
Whoa. They should be decreasing as you get more understanding, more wisdom. Oops. So anyway, here we go. With a simile, the driver of this bus, it's a waste of time complaining. So, is it possible to experience sparks of nimittas before the five sense disappears completely? Yes. The real nimittas, the strong ones, are when the five senses really disappear. And that's usually the jhanas. But when the five senses get weakened and the sixth sense, the mind, gets strengthened, it gets to the point where their strength is about equal, which means the nimitta can peep up and see above the five senses. So you get little sparks or flashes of nimittas. That means the five senses have been calmed down. The energy is going to the sixth sense. So I think I mentioned that earlier. If you really get lots of meditation, nimittas and jhanas and stuff, then that nimitta can be with you all day. So much so that sometimes you're eating your food, you have to eat through the nimitta, a big light in front of you. Because it's really strong. The mind is very powerful and the five senses are very weak. So, as the nimitta gets stronger, the five senses get weaker. So that means the light gets brighter and you can hardly feel the senses. So that's how it works. It doesn't mean the five senses have totally disappeared. That's when nimitta is really strong and you're on the edge of jhanas. Someone told me that being a therapist who provides direct patient care is bad. Oh, come on, don't believe. That's called fake news. I don't know who told us that being a therapist who provides direct patient care is bad. It is because he or she will absorb the negative energy from all the patients or clients that come to him or her. Of course you do that. That means I'm like a therapist who provides direct patient care for all of you. Does that mean that I have to get all the negative energy from you? No. It doesn't mean when I go into places like prisons, I get all the negative energy there. No. So you don't get the negative energy, but you can actually see the beautiful part of those patients. You can get their positive energy. Bring out the positive energy which is in those patients. Just wonderful. One of the doctors, I can't really say who she is, that she told me just one of the lunch times, just at the start of this retreat. One of her patients in the hospital, she was in like a coma, and they tried to get some means to get her out of that coma. And she really shouldn't have been in a coma. The brain damage or whatever it wasn't that bad. But they tried to stimulate her to start speaking and just make contact with others. And all the drugs never worked. And in the end, all this doctor did was spend 5 minutes tucking her in the bed, getting the blanket and making it nice and folded and putting it there and tucking her in. And just that little act of kindness brought the patient out into the world. And he started talking to the doctor. So, by giving some positive energy, you get this positive response back. And of course, the doctor was really rapt, very happy that because she was with a person who's obviously so negative, just wanted to hide deep inside her mind, that she brought her out with some kindness. And so that is actually how, if you provide therapy to somebody and it works, especially you, people actually, they come back and they say, thank you so much, you saved my life. Do you get negative energy out of that? No, you get really a big boost of happiness. So, you know, being a therapist who provides direct patient care can be a wonderful career. It's kindness, compassion. How can that be bad? So I don't know who you got that from, but someone told me, but that certainly wasn't me. Tell us something about women's rights and the importance of equality for all, please. Love to hear your views. It's rights, equality. There's something inside of me which says, well, notice the why not sort of response. Can women become nuns? Why not? Buddha allowed that. Can we have same-sex marriage? Why not? Can you have people with mental illness, such as schizophrenia, becoming monks? Why not? So it's always allow people in, unless there's a real good reason. Why not? A lot of time when you have inclusion and you have to sort of find some decent reason why not, it makes it far more acceptable, embracing sort of society. Because all the time when I've said that, why not? And then you find there's no reason for it, and you give people a chance. I don't know if I said this recently, but when it came to the inclusion of, you know, women in the Sangha, why not? It's just, I can't understand if it's there in the time of the Buddha. And even, you know what the Buddha said? This is in the Mahakamavibhanga Sutta. He said, the best acts of good karma you can get, if you like, put it in local new jargon, the biggest bang for your bucks, if you give a donation, used to be to not just to a person, not to an enlightened person, not even to a Buddha, but to a Sangha where the Buddha's leading it. And now, once the Buddha has passed away, he said, the best karmic return you can get on your investments, to put it in a gross way, is to give a gift to the jewel Sangha of bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. I'm going to show you the quote for that. So it's amazing in so many countries. You know, monks, senior monks have stopped you making really good karma for yourselves. Fortunately, here in Perth, we do have jewel sanghas. We're making those jewel sanghas all over the world. So, you know, monks and nuns. So, it's the best merit you can make. So, of course, yeah, you can come in. And next, okay, you know, just women's rights, but what about the LGBTQI and plus? Okay, I'm a bit tired today, so sometimes I get the last letters, but no, it's being inclusive. So, first time years ago that this man came up, and he was a very good Buddhist, always very supportive, but he was gay. Everybody knew he wasn't sort of hiding his sexual preferences. And he said, I'd like to become a monk in your monastery. Was that a problem? I said, well, you know, I know you. You know, can you keep the rules here? And he said, yeah. And then I asked him, just quite openly, what if, like, a young man came in this monastery and you got very hot about him? You liked him. What would you do? That was a question I asked him. And he said, I'd just go back to my hut and lay down. And calm myself down. It's the same question you ask a young monk. a young monk, a young fellow who comes into this monastery and you see a nice beautiful girl come in, what do you do? And so that's why it was a big danger in Thailand. You know, as you probably know, that we lived in jungles. And just, you know, many monks were afraid of tigers, but tigers never ate any monks. But you know who did? Thai girl. They were far more dangerous. And there are many monks who died because of that. It's nothing to do with Thai girls or something. It's just, you know, young men and young women. Just, you know, sometimes that it's not meant to be. But anyway, so there you go, that you have like a gay person, man comes in. So it's always to me, it's why not? Well, if you can handle it and you're okay, you can live a very good life, yeah, give it a try. And there's a number of, I won't tell you who they are, but there's a number of very wonderful monks who were gay before. And it's, you know, somehow or other they have this wonderful ability to connect with others. So you know, they're very popular, really good teachers. And then you've got other people, like people with physical disabilities, even like old monks. I know that in some places they say, oh, if you're over 50, then you can't ordain as a monk. I said, why not? Same question, why not? If it's a case that you're really sick and you're old and taking lots of looking after, then I can understand why. You know, because it will take up the time of many of the other monks, just like being nurses to you all the time. But if a person has really helped out, they've served and looked after, I feel terrible that, you know, they've looked after me and they've given donation and looked after the temple. And, you know, they're reasonably fit. Why not? So it's always a why not. So, you know, even in the time of the Buddha, there was this man. And I always go back to the suttas and the Vinaya. There's no rule prohibiting age discrimination from joining the Sangha. And there was this man who's 120 years of age. Believe it or not, it's 120th year. Didn't totally complete 120. Might be 119 in sort of the way we look at it in the West. And he became a monk. And the Buddha ordained him. And about 3 or 4 months later, you know, he became fully enlightened. And then a couple of months later, he died. It's called leaving it to the last minute. But he did it. And so you say, well, why not? So it really depends on the people. And just, you know, give people the benefit of the doubt. Give them the openness. Give them the kindness and respect. They're not rejected just because they're old. Or even what happens if you ordain a fat monk? Well, it depends. If you can live the monastic life, if you can, fine. So it's always like being inclusive and the why not. And so that sometimes you can see that people get discriminated against. And by discriminated, they get excluded, rejected, they're not part of things. They're like stigmatized. And if a person's been in jail, can they become a monk? Why not? Now, one of these retreats years ago, I think it was actually the Biff retreat, that there was, organizing a cook, you know, for the retreat. And it was very difficult to find a cook. So we got this fellow who was the cook for the retreat. Now, what was his name again? Just over from Carl now. I forget what his name was now. But anyway, Carl. Yes, right, great. Carl, thank you for that. Carl, and he was a cook. He did everything almost by himself, and he was just on work release from the prison up the road. So I think at the time, he was a serial rapist, I think. At least that's what he was in jail for. But you know what I say, there's no such thing as a rapist or a murderer. There's a person We do that stupid thing, maybe a long time ago. But anyway, he was there cooking for everybody. And he was an amazing cook. You know, he would actually make these pizzas. He'd make the dough by himself and the topping by himself and everything. And he was such an amazing hard worker. But I never told anybody that they were being served their food by a prisoner up the road. Because they'd have thought, this is terrible. You mean you've got somebody like that staying in your monastery or staying being the cook in this retreat center? Why not? He was safe, and I trusted him totally. So it's always a case of why not? Of respecting a person. And just treating a person because of, you know, not what they've done in the past or where they come from, but who they are now, and just what they can do now. And if you trust a person like that, are they always wise to the occasion? Imagine that people don't trust you, and then they always look for the worst in you, and they treat you with fear and contempt. And what would that feel like if that was you? It's terrible. That's one of the reasons why. You know, it's not just women's rights or gay people's rights, it's even like people with mental health issues' rights. Well, not rights, to be treated fairly. Elderly people's rights. Not elderly, but just to treat them with respect. And it's a lot of times that you see people, and the elderly people have huge amounts to offer. Yeah, maybe they'll not be able to sort of work hard like mixing concrete or digging trenches. But they have their other gifts and uses. So when you see everybody has something to contribute, it's wonderful to give them the opportunity to contribute. And that means that this place is Buddhism, monasticism, and it can thrive. Where other people feel they're rejected. They're judged even before they come into the place because of some reputation of the past. In this place, you're not judged on something which happened years ago, or even like weeks ago. You're judged on who you are now. And of course, the great example is Angulimala. For those of you who know the Buddhism, he was a serial killer. And then just notice the Buddha the way that he was, if you like, stopped from his evil ways, he was chasing after the Buddha to kill him. And wanted to kill the Buddha. And then the Buddha did this. Sometimes psychic powers are cool. They're not just laser eyes for fun to impress people. This was when he was running, but not running. And Angulimala just couldn't catch up with him. And so Angulimala shouted out to the Buddha, "Stop!" And the Buddha said, "I have stopped. It's about time you stopped." And that word, stop, is one of my favorite words. If you want to get into deep meditation, just stop. Don't go anywhere. Don't try and get somewhere else. Just stop right here and see what happens. When you stop, really stop, you're still. When you're still, you go into these incredible meditations. So that's one of the reasons why. Sometimes I read these articles, they're making like these freeways now, or roundabouts and underpasses. They're trying to get rid of traffic lights. That's terrible, because every time I come to a traffic light and I see this beautiful sign, stop, I say, that is Dhamma. That is the Buddha teaching. When I see the green light, go, I say, where are you going? It's much better to stop. Why are people frustrated for stopping? And they're happy when it's a green light which says go. Should be the other way around. And it was true that years ago I read this, and somebody actually told me it was true. I think this was in Chennai. I thought it was Mumbai, but I think it was Chennai, that there on I think the municipal authority had this brilliant idea that when you come to the traffic lights, the red light never says stop. It says relax. So those intersections have relax lights, not stop lights. How cool is that? Even when we, when we built this place, the builder, just because had trucks coming in and out, he left the signs, stop and slow down, because that big truck's coming. So when they went to the Kingsbury Drive, there's a big stop sign there. And when they actually came the other way down the hill, it was slow. And I asked if we can keep those. I thought it was a wonderful place, wonderful sign for a retreat centre. But he said they took them away. But wouldn't it be wonderful? You come in here and you have those two signs, one on either side, one on the left, one on the right. Stop and slow down. That's what a retreat centre is all about. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I believe you do not watch TV or online, etc. I wonder how you know so much things that happen around the world. And you share with us. Now, I do watch the news, the ABC News and BBC News, on my little laptop. Not a laptop, it's a tablet, yeah, I've got those. And the other things that I was telling one of the Indonesian men that the last time I was in Indonesia, Handaka was, after the, does these talk shows. So I give a talk and he does his thing, as his son well knows. He's very, very outgoing, is Mr. Handaka, or Mom Handaka. Although it's not Mom Handaka's, that's his son. Where is he? It's like Dad Handaka for him. Anyway, afterwards he has his questions. And the first night in Indonesia this time, he asked me this question, that if you were, please excuse me, I've got it wrong, Thanos, and you had to destroy one or two things, what would you destroy? I said, what the heck are you talking about? Because Thanos, was that right? He was this really big evil one. And so he asked me, I don't know what you're talking about, and please explain. And he did it very quickly. And I said, look, I'm a monk. I don't destroy anything. I'd probably destroy the instrument which you could destroy things with. But anyway, that wasn't such a good answer. So the next day, when we were traveling to the next destination, it wasn't him, it was actually Tashfam, one of the other people in Ahipaska. He actually was giving me a brief summary of what happened with Thanos and where it all came from and what all these superheroes were and what they did and stuff. And so I had to get that as like a briefing so that the next time he asked me the question, I had a better idea of what he was talking about. So there's a lot of stuff I don't understand in the world, where things happen. Even, what was it? Were you there when you were giving me a foot massage with Jayako and reflexology? And they were starting talking about video games. And I didn't know what they were talking about. It was all gobbledygook to me. All those video games they used to play before they became monks. I hope it's before they became monks. But anyway, what are you talking about? And they were just going on comparing notes and stuff, and I just was zoning out.
In 1999,
okay, well, I'm not quite sure. Video games. But there's some things which I just don't understand, because it's way after my time. So, there's some things I know about the world, like about greed, hatred, and delusion. Doesn't differ. But there was one interesting thing I remember years ago when I was a monk in Thailand, that we didn't see a newspaper or any news for about a year or 2 years. And it was really remote and just off the radar of the world. And then when I actually got a newspaper, I think it was a Time magazine, you know, the old Time magazines, and I read it and it was really weird. It was exactly the same stories as 2 years previously, just different names, different countries, different film stars or music stars are getting divorced and getting married, and different sort of politicians, you know, being corrupt, and different sports teams, you know, winning when they shouldn't win. And it was exactly the same news, just the names have been changed. And I think that's probably true for this generation as well. Same news, people being corrupt, too much power, and too much mischief going on. And unfortunately sometimes people die and they have terrible diseases because of that. But look at the news, it's pretty much the same. Just see, that's why there's a lot of truth in Shakespeare's saying, all the life's a stage, and all the players, all the people are players on it. And actually the plot never changes. Just the people, the actors, and the intensity. Dear Ajahn, what are the precepts relating to jhanas? Precepts? Wow, you've stumped me at last, a question I don't understand. But I just know that, you know, just what are precepts anyway? Sometimes that, you know, we people, five precepts. What are the five precepts? But then you hear that some people keep eight precepts. Wow, that's even more. Does that mean it's better that you get jhanas with eight precepts? And usually the eight precepts are precepts you keep only, you know, if you're in a monastery or you're on a retreat, or that on the moon days, the big moon days, people go to the monasteries and they take the eight precepts. And I remember going to a Sri Lankan monastery years ago, and people were taking the 13 precepts. And I thought, wow, I've never heard that before. What are the 13 precepts on the big moon day, like on a Waisak day? They take 13 precepts. I thought, that's really advanced, much better than five precepts or eight precepts. And they explained to me, oh no, what the 13 precepts mean is we take eight precepts in the morning and five precepts in the afternoon. But then, the Thais, and those are lovable, they're just naughty. Any loophole they can find, that in the northeast this is. And that's where, when I went there, you know, after being in Australia for a while, I went back to Thailand and had a go to the northeast, and then I saw that people taking the five precepts, they had the one finger down. I think I mentioned this to you. That meant, if they had one finger down, that meant they're only taking four precepts today. They chant all five. You know, Parati, Parati, Nardana, Kamesa, they chant everything. They'd have one finger down, which meant only keeping four. And then after that, you know, I sort of really looked. And of course, you looked a little while and saw someone with two fingers down. They're only keeping three precepts today. And then you saw somebody with... they're doing all the chant, they weren't keeping any precepts at all. But always tell people that, look, sometimes, especially if you get old, eight precepts, what are they? Do you know what they are? And all the ins and outs and loopholes and stuff. Ooh, I'm sure it's back in. Where's that gone? Yeah, okay. So all the loopholes and stuff. But so I tell them, just keep two precepts. Well, that's really good. What are the two precepts? Never doing anything which harms another, and never doing anything which harms yourself. That's it. Two precepts. Easy to understand and remember. So just keep those two precepts. And all the other precepts, they fall into line. And it doesn't mean that you find loopholes for those precepts. It means you don't do anything which is harmful. and to yourself and to others. And that's the precepts which are for everything, for jhanas, for meditation, for eating. So be harmless. And that's a beautiful expression of all the precepts, and that derives from the Buddha's advice to his son, Rahula. That's what he said to Rahula, don't do anything which harms another, don't do anything which harms yourself. I don't feel much joy when I was giving. How to experience more joy in giving so that I can give more and more and more? Sometimes have a look at other people's gifts. What are the most amazing gifts you've ever seen? And because I've been a monk for such a long time, I've seen some just gifts which make you cry. There was this, I watched one. There was this Laotian girl, and she was in the refugee camp, you know, after the Vietnam War, you know, the Laotian Cambodian. And she, for some reason, she was sent to Perth, while all her relations were sent to Portland, Oregon. And the family was split up. And her mother, her brothers and sisters were all in the United States, and she was in Perth alone. It was just an administrative error. But, you know, she was making a life for herself. You know, she would come to our temple. But then one day, she was there and she was crying her eyes out, you know, in front of me. I said, why? What's happened? She just got a telegram in those days. A telegram or a fax or something from one of her brothers. Her mother was really sick and was dying. And she was a refugee. She didn't have the money, you know, to get to a place like United States from where she was. You know, she was just struggling to pay the bills. And I think you all know, if that's your mother and she's dying, this is your last chance to see her. Even as a Kuai Lo, you know, as a Pule, that's the Indonesian word for Westerner. That, you know, that this is a Farang. That, you know, even that just really hurts you. It's your mother, your father, you have to go and see them. And when you can't, that tears at your heart. And that's even more intense, I know, because, you know, been living in Thailand for such a long time, that's even more intense for an Asian. It's your mum, you have to go and see her. But she couldn't. And she was just weeping and crying. And as she was doing that, there was another woman who was fighting to get compensation because she was a nurse. She'd injured herself picking up a patient. She was out of work. She'd been out of work for about a year. Just, you know, getting by on just unemployment benefits. And then she was right behind this Lao lady. And this lady was Thai, and she just got out her checkbook and wrote a blank check, signed it. Go and see your mum. Doesn't matter how much it costs. And she was poor, this Thai lady. She was out of work. But that didn't stop her writing a blank check. Fill it out yourself, however much it costs. So the Lao lady could go and see her mum for one last time. That's beautiful. That's the sort of giving which really impresses me. And it's not just that. I just say these monks just working all night to complete this floor, just, they don't sit on it. Just for the sake that getting this retreat center all finished in time so we can have retreats in this place. So, there was one of the other great acts of kindness was when there was when I was a young monk in Thailand, in the hall at Wat Nanachat, that it was my job to do the sweeping and clean it up. So I was in the afternoon, I was in there by myself, just sweeping it, cleaning it up. And then I was behind a cupboard when I heard somebody come in. And they came in, you know, quietly, And it was like a thief coming in. And so I just wondered what was going on. I just peeked behind the cupboard so this person wouldn't see me. And I recognized her. It was a village girl who was had some brain damage or something at birth. She couldn't speak. She could only grunt. And of course, because you're in that village, you got arms round every morning, you see everybody, all the festivals and the entry to the rains and containers, they all come there. So you get to know every villager. And this girl, she was so amazing that she could not speak like language. She would just grunt, and her friends knew exactly what she was saying. It was like a private language. And she would go to every festival. She was never excluded. She was part of everything. And that's why, you don't exclude people just because they're different. And her friends or other girlfriends would take her to the parties. And so she would join in everything. But then I saw her creeping in to the temple. She was looking around to make sure that no one could see her. And I saw her put something on the shrine in front of the Buddha. She was giving a gift. And I just let her do that. And she quickly did that. She bowed very quickly and ran out. I wonder, what has she given? And what she had done, she'd folded a piece of paper into like a lotus flower to present, to the Buddha image. And I looked at that. It wasn't exactly just well done. You could have done a much more well-folded sort of origami lotus flower. But that wasn't the point. This girl, maybe 13 or 14, it was so difficult for her to do something. That was the best she could do, which is one of the reasons why she snuck in there to give it, because she was afraid that someone would stop her because it wasn't good enough. And she put it on that shrine. And afterwards, I remember telling every monk in there, if any one of you takes that away and throws it away, you're going to see the violent part of Ajahn. Not really violent, but they understood that was so difficult for this girl to make and to put on the shrine. That was just one of the biggest acts of generosity I've ever seen. That was worth millions. If that was a golden flower, I'd throw that one away, but not this one, because it took so much effort and she was so shy putting it up there. That was a brilliant act of kindness. And the other act of kindness, I love saying these things because they really make sort of me goosebumped. And I can feel just all this energy coming up now. Just amazing, just what happens. This was where we started our nuns monastery, that story. Getting nuns monasteries, okay, yeah, it's a nice thing to do, but how do you do that? The first thing I did was I put this article in our newsletter. Let's get nuns monastery started. And just see if people wanted it. And so we just, basically not many people were interested at first. But we opened up a bank account. That doesn't cost anything. And we maybe had about 10,000 in there or 15,000. And that sounds a lot of money, but you can't buy a caravan for that, let alone the land to put it on. So it wasn't really going anywhere. And then what happened? Just in front of the kitchen at Jhanagram, this is when it only had one story, not the second story. This gentleman came, this Aussie fellow, and he was in the traditional Australian uniform. Thongs, flip-flops, shorts, and a singlet. And he came in an old car. And so I didn't think very much, but he said, Ajahn Brahm, I need to see you. I hear you're raising funds for a nun's monastery. And I, to look at him, I didn't expect that he would give very much. And I always stereotype. I get caught on that every time, stereotyping. Just looking at a person, they're not going to offer very much, or look at someone who's really well dressed, oh, you know, I better be kind to them, and then maybe get a few. But anyway, this guy, he said, oh, my wife gave birth to my first child a couple of days ago. It was a daughter. He said, I'm a Buddhist. And he said to me, he said, he wants to make a contribution to our nuns' monastery. And he said, he wants to do that in honour of the birth of his first child, a girl. And he said, I don't know if my daughter would be interested in Buddhism, let alone becoming a nun, but I want her to have the chance, to have the choice. If she wants to, I want her to be in a monastery where she can be respected and live that life just like every other person can. So he gave me a check, a contribution, $250,000. $250,000. And that was a few years ago, and that just, I couldn't believe it. And he was, shaking. And he went away. The check, cleared. And I've never seen him again. That was the weird part. You know, I thought he'd at least come and say, how's it going? You know, is it need any more money, or can I come and to the opening ceremony, or anything? But he disappeared. And that was the weirdest part. So often, you know, you can't be sure. How did he know? And came in an old car, and not sort of a usual, very wealthy person. And sometimes I wonder whether that was like a heavenly being. So apparently that happens. Like devas, they come and they just want to help out really good projects. Sometimes, where the heck is he? Why hasn't he shown up? I've told this story many times. I'm hoping that, you know, he might hear one of these talks and just comes out, it's me. But he never has.
He was down on a retreat in Sydney, Raja.
He was?
Yeah.
Ah, stop disappointing me. That was a great story. Who was he? Oh, yeah. Are you sure? Are you sure that it wasn't a deva just appearing? Yeah, but anyway, it's a brilliant sort of little gift. And it's wonderful that it was given like that. That just also gives me just amazing, unexpected generosity. Anyway, dear Ajahn, we're going to Dhammasala and Dhammaloka tomorrow. Could you please tell about those two monasteries? Well, I know I've already showed that how we started off with getting some funds to buy that place. But the nice stories were that when we had some money to buy something, that was with Bianca. You know, some of you know Bianca because she'd come to those other retreats and her partner at that time, he died a few years ago. But then, we're going down this road, Reen Road. It was a 30-acre property on sale, which was within our price range, 30 acres. Now that may sound a lot over in Hong Kong. But when we saw it, I went to see it and I thought, is that what you want to give to bhikkhunis, to nuns? That's really just the message I got from that small piece of land, was that bhikkhunis weren't worth it. They weren't really valued. You know, over here, even the monks had 100 acres, just 30 little acres for nuns. That was demeaning. But as we went down that Reen Road, there was this big sign saying, 583 acres or something of pristine bush and serenity. And when I saw that, I said, hey, let's go and have a look. No, we can't afford that, said Bianca and Ron Battersby at the time. And said, no, it doesn't cost anything to look. So we went in to have a look, and oh, it was just really impressive. And so I said, that's what I want for our nuns. 500 acres of beautiful forest. It's perfect. But how on earth can we afford that? So what we did, it was on auction. So on auction, you never know what's going to happen. So with another monk, I went in there early. We went to the hill, the center of the whole piece of land, and we chanted, really chanted, full on, full power, getting all the heavenly beings on side. Maybe that was just, you know, cheating in an auction, but I don't know. And then the auction started. And, you know, by borrowing a bit here and seeing what we got over there, that our limit was 600,000. We couldn't do more than that. They would bankrupt us. We'd be in big trouble. We wouldn't be able to pay it off. So our treasurer informed the auction, the bidder who was doing it for us, 600,000 is our limit. You can't go over that. So the bidding started. It was really exciting. That's where I learned. Now the auctioneer started, it's a beautiful piece of land, so serene. Now, can I hear a bid for 400,000? 400,000, do I hear more than 400? 425, 450? And you can see how it gets everyone excited. And people put their hand up and they're in big trouble. So anyway, somebody bid 500,000. 525, and our fellow said 550. Someone said 575, and our man said 600. And I was just using all the powers to try and keep everybody's mouth shut, so they couldn't speak. And then another gentleman put their hand up, 625. Oh. And then our bidder, 650! And our treasurer says, stop him, we can't afford that, he's got no authority, he can't do that, no! So I used my power to shut up my treasurer. Well, I could do. And it passed at 650. In other words, we got it. And, so how are we going to pay for that? Oh, come on! It's inspiring. And when it's inspiring, always good things happen. So eventually that we managed to borrow a bit more here, take a loan over there, and, you know, find out 650, we got it. And of course that's now Dharmasala Nuns Monastery. And you go there, it's amazing. And of course just building it, they had no buildings on there at all at first. And the first nun up there, Ajahn Wayama, oh, she was just really impressive. Just so she was living in a small caravan. It was hot, full of flies, and she survived that. What she did was just really prove that women are up to it. That she got respect by her endurance and her wisdom. And that was an important thing that people all realized. But why not? These women renunciants were as good as, if not better than, the monks. So, give them a chance, and now it's flourished. So that's Dhammasara. Dhammaloka, that's our city centre. Call it a monastery, it's more like a vihara. But also, that's a beautiful place. It's lots of stuff going on over there, and you'll see it tomorrow. That's where we go to do most of the teaching. In other words, so that the monasteries can be quiet and secluded, so not many people come and visit. Oh my goodness, too many more of these to go. I need to be consistent with my meditation. How do I do that, please? Super glue. Put it on your meditation cushion and on your bottom, and just sit down there so you can't get up. Now that doesn't work, obviously. But being consistent, if you're not, why do you want to be consistent? Why do you have to be consistent? So it's like say, eating. Sometimes, if you are you consistent eating? Well, can't you be consistent when you are meditating? If you see the benefit of it, and it's important, you enjoy it. I enjoy meditation, so it's not like, ooh, I'm a monk, I suppose I better go meditate now. Ooh, I suppose I better go meditate in the morning so you can know that I'm a meditator. I just, you know, so I can show off. You don't do that. I meditate because I enjoy it. And I look forward to it. And I say, you know, sometimes you haven't had time to meditate because you've been busy doing stuff, then you go back to your room. Yeah, my own time now, let's meditate. And it just, they have the saying in the suttas, your mind leaps onto meditation. It's just like, you know, if you haven't seen your dog for a week and you come into the house, apartment, the dog leaps all onto you and licks you to death. Well, not to death, but you know what I mean. He's so happy to see you. And that's just like, you know, the meditation. You know, if I've neglected my meditation for a while, then I come in and meditation sees me and it leaps all over me. Because we're friends. So we go have lots of good time together. That's how you're consistent with the meditation. Because you like it. I am not a vegetarian. I sometimes have a glass of wine. Does it mean I'll never see jhana? Sometimes if you have too much wine, you may think you see jhana. Just a jhana. No, you can still see jhanas. It's just a matter of just, are you harming yourself or harming others? So it really depends on each individual. But you know, even like wine, it's non-alcoholic wine. So if you like the taste, have some of that. Or just, you know, have a tiny bit of wine. How do one be kind to his, her own mind and have peace when he, she got hurt in a broken relationship where the other is long gone or dead? Oh, if you got hurt in a broken relationship, you're so lucky. She's now long dead. What was that? There was this fellow, and he was at the cemetery and he was crying his eyes out by a grave. And a person said, oh, why are you crying? Is that your wife? Oh no, so how's this one? This goes, it's a joke. Is that your brother or your father? Because the guy, you know, on the gravestone, he said, no, that was my wife's first husband. If he hadn't have died, I'd be the happiest man. My wife's first husband. So if he hadn't have died, I'd be a very happy man. Figure it out. My wife's first husband. Okay, I did try. You had a broken relationship. Relationships break. If not now, when you die. So it's a wonderful test to see if you can work out a relationship. And you always try, and I always advise, give it a go. There's many things you can do to keep the relationship going. But if it does break, it gives you some sense of freedom. Saying that, you know, I had relationships, I had a long one once when I was young. And then, you know what happened? She left me for another guy. Thank you so much! If you hadn't have left me, I would have never got to become a monk. Oh, that was so close. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. But you know, sometimes you have a wonderful time with your partner. It's a lot of letting go you have to do. So how to be kind to his, her own mind and have peace? Why do you allow the scars of the past
to actually to keep being infected and stop you being happy. And a lot of time you have a wound and you keep scratching it or worrying about it. So let that wound from the past heal over. Cover it over with grass, as they say in Buddhism. And little by little you learn from that pain. You don't sort of stop your happiness. You learn from it. It's like the old simile of treading in the dog poo. And you never scrape it off your shoes when you tread in dog poo. Until you go home. And then you scrape it off under the long gantry. Because you like long hands. And so what happens when you scrape it off under the long gantry, 1 year later your long hands are sweeter than ever. And you must always remember, you know, that simile that when you eat those long hands, and they're really juicy, I mean they're really juicy. Why? Because you're eating dog poo. It's true, isn't it? You've been transformed into juicy long hands. So, that's when you had a broken relationship, it really hurt. But you haven't dug it in yet. You're still carrying it around in your pockets, it's still festering. Dig it in. You become a kinder, happier, wiser person. You grow fruit from that bad experience instead of allowing it just to take away your happiness. Anyway, I felt like my skins are being pulled when I meditate. Really, that's interesting. But afterwards I feel really good about it. Great. Can you please explain what happened? That's interesting. I think what happened was that you were feeling your skins were being pulled and after you feel really good about it. Whatever happened, it was obviously something there, your body was relaxing or whatever. And as long as you feel good about it, explain what happened, it was some sort of letting go, some relaxation, some happiness. So you don't need to sort of figure it all out if you feel good afterwards. Back at home, it's so noisy, sound of cars, dog, children, etc. Does this mean the heaving sense will not disappear as there's always a constant change in the sound, thank you? No, you can. After a while you learn how to sort of not listen to the sound. Because people always talk about their marriage, they said that it takes about average of 5 or 6 years of married life to be able to hear your wife without listening it to her. That's what someone told me. In other words, you're talking, you hear the sounds actually impinging on your brain, but you're not listening. If you could only do that with the sound of cars, dogs, children, etc. around you. In other words, you don't give importance. Now, those were just a little bit of joke things, but how you actually do that in practice is it's using the simile of the TV. Because I do have to watch the TV when you go on aircraft and you have the safety movie on the back of the seat. And if you're looking at the back of the seat, you see the safety movie on there. I notice when I first look at that, I can see the upholstery of the seat in front of me and the plastic rim of the screen and actually the screen itself. But I noticed after a few seconds, I can't see the upholstery of the chair in front of me. In fact, I can't even see the plastic screen. It's like my mind zooms in, and it zooms in just to fit the screen. Which is why, I remember as a kid, I used to go to these cinemas and have these huge screens to watch the movie. And you know, even on people's houses, they have huge TV sets. But now people can watch a movie or just on their iPhone. It's a tiny screen. And I thought, how can you enjoy a movie on a tiny screen like that? Well, you find that after a while you zoom in and your mind just fits the screen. and you can't even see the edges of the screen. And it's this is the nature of focusing. You focus in. So what that simile meant for me, you are meditating, you say you can watch your breathing, breathing in, but there's all this noise. Make sure you don't center on the noise. You keep your breath, say, in the center of your screen. You can hear the noise really loud over here, really loud over there, but you center on your breathing, which means you can actually zoom in. And all that noise can literally fall off the edge of the screen, and you're not aware of it. Well, what many people do, the noise is so disturbing, you put actually the noise in the center of the screen. Why are they doing this? Can't I get a better place to meditate? And because the noise is your main concern, that's in the center, and after a while the breath falls off the screen. So that's literally how the focusing happens. And noticing, that's a common way your eyes and your brain works. You know, first of all it has a wide view, and then automatically it sort of zooms in on something, which is what you're really interested in. And that's what happens if you give the interest to your breathing and forget about the noise. Then the noise vanishes and disappears. So you can do that. It takes a bit of practice and training. But the point is that even if you've got a quiet place like this, well, sometimes you're meditating and you're watching your breath, it's going well, but then you get an ache in your knee. It's not sort of a very big pain, but it's disturbing. And if you center on the ache in the knee, that takes center screen, then of course your breath disappears. But if you keep the breath in the center, you're not trying to get rid of the achy knee. You can feel it, you know it's happening, but you're focusing, the center is on the breath. And after a little while, the achy knee, don't know where it's gone, but you're not aware of it anymore because you've zoomed in to the center. Focusing and zooming in. I'm a complicated woman, especially when it comes to decision making. How to make it simple? Very easy. When I was visiting Oslo some years ago, this woman in the audience, who's Oslo University, she put her hand up, she wanted to ask a question, and she says, I have an important decision to make in my life. How do I make it? And so I looked at her and said, well, suppose it's a decision whether to marry your boyfriend sitting next to you. Oh, and she went red in the face. I shouldn't do things like that. But I busted her. That was what she was thinking about. And so it wasn't a really good thing for me to do that. But anyway, it made it sort of more alive. And she was contemplating marrying. Should I accept his proposal or not? It's a life-changing decision. So it's important. How can she make that decision? So I said, easy. Toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. And of course, people laughed at one of our jump bomb jokes, but I said, this is not a joke. You toss a coin. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. And so you toss the coin, heads I marry him, and it comes up heads. What is your reaction? This is the important point of the exercise. How do you react when it comes up heads I marry him? Is it
yes?
Or is it, let's try 2 out of 3. And if it's 2 out of 3, it means you don't want to marry him. You're not ready yet. It's not the time or whatever. But at least it shows you how you feel. Your intuitive answer to that problem. And that's the one you should follow. So the tossing of the coin is just to reveal, you know, what you really feel is the right decision. And get beyond or past all of that thinking and which drives you crazy. So that's actually one way of doing it. Find out what you really want to do. Toss a coin. Heads, I become a nun. Tails, I don't. I stay in the lay world. So toss the coin. You toss it. Heads. Become a monk. That's not what I want. At least it reveals it for you. And the second part about decision making, when you do make a decision, just understand, I think you can appreciate this, whatever decision you make is not really that important. What really is important is what you do after you make the decision. So you keep all your energy and effort so that when you made the decision, you make that decision work for you. So just like, similarly, you go outside, you turn left, or you turn right. If you turn left, you make that decision work. If you turn right, you make that decision work. You keep the energy for what you do afterwards. And that's true. You go out of this hall, you turn left. You know, you go over the garden, the stupas. You can make that work. In fact, it's quite a shortcut to the upper cottages. You should try it. If you turn right, then you go just round the back of the hall, and you can go to the lower cottage by that way. And even if you turn right and you live in the upper cottages, it doesn't matter because the path goes all the way round and you get to the upper cottages. Whatever path you take, it always gets round to the end. So does it really matter which choice you make? Or does it really matter that once you made the choice, you make it work? You keep the energy and all the effort for what you do after you've turned left or right. Dear Ajahn, what is a practical way to overcome addiction? Loving yourself. Because addiction is like self-destruction, self-harm. And it's because you don't think you're worth it much that you sort of try and destroy your happiness. But if, you know, you have this beautiful sense of realizing your self-worth, and the fact that, you know, you're a lotus. You know, maybe on the outside it's a bit damaged, but on the inside is this beautiful, beautiful in the middle of the lotus. Once you understand that, you realize you don't need to sort of destroy yourself and self-destruct, which is what addictions do. And once you realize you're worth it, it's any addiction you can find a way out of, if you want to. If you think there's something worth protecting and saving. That's one of the best ways to overcome addiction. Have a better, wonderful, beautiful attitude to yourself. You belong. After I feel the tingling sensation moving through my body, then as you suggested, I bring it back to my breath. However, there's still some vision, images in the background when I'm watching the breath. It's like I'm watching the breath, but there's also some wandering mind behind it. How is this possible? How to deal with it? Use that focusing technique, like I mentioned earlier, where you can just focus on the breath and the other stuff. You know, you know it's there, but you don't pay too much attention to it. And after a while, it disappears and falls off your screen. How to be more confident and believe in ourselves? I often do not believe what my heart told me unless I hear it from somebody else. So record what your heart tells you and then play it back. Then you hear it from somebody else. That was a good attempt to try and answer the question, but anyway, obviously it didn't go down very well. One way to believe in yourself and have that confidence, that is that simile of doing the 10 push-ups in the morning. My exercise. When I get up in the morning, I go to the toilet, and then afterwards, I do my 10 push-ups. Do you think I do exercises? Of course I do. 1, 2, 3. I really have to use this. I don't need to be thin as a monk, but I really need to learn how to smile. Because a lot of time people take photographs of me, and if I don't smile, that's just really bad for business. So I exercise every morning. So So anyway, and that's actually how you have some confidence and believe in yourself. Just happiness and joy gives you that confidence. So if any thoughts come into mind when we are meditating, we just need to be kind to it by allowing it until it disappears. However, it will not disappear because you're not kind enough to it. So be a bit more kind. In Buddhism, living being, how was it first formed in this world? First formed? Beginnings? Why should there be beginnings? So, here we go. So this is science now. If you haven't heard this one before. This is when I was young, you heard in history that 300, 400 years ago, people believed that this earth was flat. And if you look at it, it looks flat. You can't see any curvature being a tiny little human being who can't actually fly in the air. It looks flat. And people actually thought if you go in a boat far enough, you'll fall off the edge. They thought the earth was flat and had an edge to it, a limit. But now, of course, you all know that the earth is a sphere, which means it's got, as every real estate agent knows, it's got limited area for habitation or even for the ocean, but it's got no beginnings or ends. It's always fascinating that every culture, before they knew that there was other cultures in other parts of the world, they always thought they were the middle of everything. Maybe in China, you know, the middle land, and even where the Buddha lived, the middle country, and even in Europe, the Mediterranean, you know, the middle. We always thought we were the center of everything. And so that even when you draw maps, I remember as a kid when I saw the maps in history, because I was born in England, they had like Britain in the middle, the center. And of course, a place like Australia was just, you know, almost off the map. It was in the corner somewhere, down the bottom. So I remember when I first came here, I saw this map in the shop, the corrected, real, respectful map of the world. And in that map, it had Australia in the top centre. Of course, you know, it was the other way around. It says, this is where Australia belongs, the top and centre. And that meant that United States, I think, was in the bottom right-hand corner somewhere. It almost disappeared. And England was in the other corner. You could hardly see it. But why do they call this place Down Under? We're not down under. We're middle on top. Just perspectives. But anyway, so the earth is round. It's got no beginning, no end. There's no top or no bottom, no middle, no edge to this world. So we all know that now. But then, being interested in science, the universe, not just this galaxy, but the whole big universe. And there was this, if there are any mathematicians or scientists, there was even for high school science, they had this Obler's paradox. And it was actually a very neat, a very simple but very convincing, a mathematical proof that the universe cannot be infinite. And of course, every scientist knows it's not. It's a limited volume, but with no edges to it. Like people sometimes say, it's like a balloon. You may have seen that simile. A balloon with little stars on it, and it's expanding. But the volume is increasing, but there's no beginning, no end. Because space is curved. So it doesn't matter how far you go, you never come to the end. If you go in any direction, go that direction over there, as really, really fast, I think, what was it, Star Trek, warp speed 6, or whatever. You actually come back to where you started. Because this universe is also curved. It's not flat. So limited volume, but no beginning and no end. No edge. So then, that's accepted. Every scientist knows that. But next, we go to time. Even today, too many people believe in flat time, like flat Earth. And I sometimes posit that 20, 30, 50 years from now, people look back upon this age, you mean you thought there's a beginning of time and an end of time? You have like flat earthers, flat timers. Because that makes no sense at all. So imagine time, which is curved, limited duration, without an edge, no beginning, no end, but curved round. So, there is no problem. There was no beginning, no end. Time goes round. Samsara cycles, huge cycles. So there's no way that we can travel that far forward that we come back to where we started. No beginnings, no end. Curved like everything else in space and time. And that was one of the reasons why I've admitted this. I did watch the movie, when I say I don't watch movies, if they're important ones, the movie which was called The Theory of Everything, Stephen Hawking, because my mate was in that movie. He wasn't actually in it, but he was represented in it. An actor played him, Bernard Carr. And so, had my ears pricked up when, just towards the end, that Stephen Hawking, he said, "I now understand a universe without any boundaries, no beginnings, no ends, in space or time." And I thought, yes, Stephen, I could have told you that 20 years ago, being an arrogant monk. So, that is why, no beginning, no end. Anyway, the last question here. What are some examples of the kind things or means we can say to our mind when it wanders off? You just say, have a beautiful journey. Don't forget, here's my email, so make sure, mind, that you can email me when you come home. In other words, just let the mind be kind to it. Sometimes, if you're on this retreat or another retreat, you actually stop every now and again and ask your body, "Body, how are you? Body, what do you need? What do you want?" And sometimes your body will say, "I need a glass of water. I need a cup of tea. I'm tired, I need some juice." And if that's what your body says, obviously let the body have it. Give it to it. Because it's the body, it's just really telling you what it really needs right now. If the body says, "I need to have a walk," so take it for a walk. The body says, "I need to lay down," let it lay down. And that's how you are kind to the body. And the body will not abuse your kindness. It will say you need a glass of water because, you know, you're getting dehydrated, you didn't realize it, you're too busy doing something else. And then sometimes the body says, I think I've mentioned this story, the body says, "I need something salty." What do you want that for? It's because you've been sweating too much, working too hard or something, and you've lost some of your salts. And the body tells you that's what you need. And it's so often the body's so correct. And then you do the same to your mind. You ask your mind, "Mind, what do you want to do right now?" And sometimes the mind will say, "I just want to just rest." Okay. So you take your mind to bed, give it a good sleep. And sometimes the mind says, you know, I want to exercise. You know, I want to maybe just listen to that sutta class and just think about it. Okay. But if you're kind to your mind like that, often my mind, your mind as well will do this. You say, mind, what do you want to do? I said, I want to meditate. You're working with your mind, you're respecting it rather than trying to tell it what it needs to do. And that means your mind doesn't wander off. There are times it needs to wander off. It's had enough of meditating. And sometimes you let it stay here and it gets very deep and very peaceful. And the times you meditate are even longer and longer. On retreats, sometimes on interviews, people come up and say, look, I'm really fed up. You know, nothing's working, meditation's no good. And I tell them, okay, just go to bed. So no, I can't go to bed. You know, this is wasting my time. You know, I paid a lot of money to get on this retreat and I've really got to practice hard, it's precious human life. I can't waste it. I said, go to sleep. And I argue with them until they do it. And they go to bed and say, don't sort of set your alarm clock. Don't think I'm going to sleep for this amount of time or that amount. Just go to bed, tuck yourself in, and see what happens. And he said, when you do wake up, just maybe take a shower, and have a glass of water, some juice, or a cup of tea or something, and then come and meditate. And it's just so consistent that when the people do that, they come up and say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, that was the best meditation ever. Because they looked after their body instead of keep pushing it. Had a nice fresh shower and a glass of water or tea or something. And your body feels so good after that. You come and meditate and the body and the mind just do it by themselves. You don't need to do anything. You're relaxed, peaceful, and you get very, very still. Just like the Buddha had the bathe, had the good meal, but I had a rest and then sat under the Bodhi tree and got enlightened. The middle way. So, that's what to do with your mind if it wanders off. If it's a perpetual wandering off and it just never gives you any peace at all, then as a last resort, give it a lobotomy. That's only supposed to be a joke. A few people laugh, they know what that word means. That means you take the brain out. But that is not the way to find some stillness inside. So instead, that you don't need to have extreme measures. But kindness actually does work. Stop. Give your mind a break. So, the last little story, because that was the last question. The last story about wandering mind and thinking too much. This was the story of the little novice in Wat Pa Phong. Because even those days, sometimes the Buddhist monasteries were almost like safety nets, social safety nets. If children didn't have anywhere else to go in the world, at least the monastery would take them in. And make sure they got a nice accommodation and a place to stay. And many of them would send them to the school or even the university where they could study, you know, when they had no other place to actually to sleep and eat at night or eat during the day. So anyway, this was a young novice who was staying at this monastery, Wat Pa Phong. And one evening Ajahn Chah was giving one of the talks and it went on and on and on. Just like Ajahn Brahm, on and on and on. You think, when is he going to stop talking? And that's what this novice started thinking. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? I'm only a young man. I'm just 10 or 11 years of age. I'm not like these big monks who are trying to get enlightened. This is the only place I've got to stop. I need to go to bed. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? I want him to stop. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that became like a repetitive mantra, like one of these old broken records. When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? Just like, you know, the kids say, when are we going to get there? When are we going to get there, Dad? When are we going to get there? When are we going to get there? The pain hasn't taken off yet. When are you going to get there? So anyway, he's, when's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? But that went on for quite a while. And then he had insights. What insight is, you just see it from a different angle. You actually turn it around. And his insight was, when am I going to stop? And that little novice stopped. That's why I said earlier about stopping is a really important word. He stopped. And when he opened his eyes, it was dawn. All the monks had left. He didn't mind, because he had blissed out the first really deep, wonderful meditation he'd ever had. So, and he didn't hear the monks, you know, bowing and... Well, they didn't do sadhu, sadhu, sadhu there like I do, but they did some chanting and got all their stuff together and left to go to bed, and they left the little novice there, blissing out, first time. Why? Because he stopped. Beautiful word. That's actually one of the reasons why I like that word, stop. Why that last question, what do you do for a wandering mind? When it wanders off, stop. Okay. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay. So what time are you actually going off to Dhammasava and Dhammaloka tomorrow? 1:30. 1:30 you're going off? Wow. So are you all going, or some going, or most going? Okay, very good. Anyway, that you have a lovely afternoon, and I will see you Dhammaloka Friday night, because I'm there as well. Can't get rid of me, or either that, or I can't get rid of you. whichever way you look at it. So anyway, have a wonderful time there, and obviously I'll see you in the morning time. Oh, and Della, what's happening on Saturday? You go to Dhammaloka again? Just the usual thing. Yeah. Oh, well, just what happens in the evening, like Q&A in the evening as well?
Do you want to do meditation?
Yeah, I think meditation is good in the afternoon. But I was just wondering about Venerable Kasapa, because what time, because we're going to be taking the tables over, I think, on Saturday afternoon, a lot of the chairs, for the ceremony on Sunday. Or maybe come and do it a bit later, maybe have to do it later.
Do it. Yeah.
Yeah, because they need them for lunch on Saturday.
It's your decision.
Yeah, okay. Power! But on Sunday, Saturday evening, do you have any dinner or anything there, or any...
We're not taking 13 precepts here.
13 precepts. Excellent. But you have having some snacks in Dhammaloka tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow.
Okay. So I think what we did last year, I think on the Sunday morning, because the tables will be gone. Are you having the breakfast tomorrow on Sunday morning here?
Yes.
So to make sure you have enough tables, make sure you hide some tables when the monks come. Okay, we'll figure a way out. Okay, very good.
I think we were okay last time.
Yeah. Okay, good, yeah. Okay, so good night, and have a good last night.
How did you go today? How was it's obviously nice to say hello to you.
He's doing all right.
Okay, great.